this is your Polycast for Thursday, September 15th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, people of color in Minnesota still lag in earnings, and some Cambodian people are fighting deportation. Minnesota's Democratic and Republican Party chairmen are both saying a Supreme Court ruling keeping Donald Trump on the November ballot works out in their favor. DFL Party Chair Ken Martin and GOP Chairman Keith Downey appeared last night at a Chamber of Commerce forum in Blaine. Martin defended the Democratic Party's legal effort to have Trump stricken from the ballot over questions about Republican Party compliance with state candidate filing laws. Martin suggested losing the court case will ultimately help Democrats.
Having Trump removed from that the ballot actually would have hurt us, not helped us. This was about holding the Republicans accountable.
Downey says Democrats went too far.
If anything, the Trump campaign supporters are more motivated. I think rank-and-file people looked at it and said, you know, what in the world were the Democrats trying to do? And I think it hurt them, and I think it backfired pretty badly.
The DFL's Martin says Hillary Clinton's campaign was not involved in the decision to sue. Minnesota's newest state Supreme Court justice will be formally sworn in today during a public ceremony in St. Paul. Tim Pugmire reports.
The Honorable Ann McKeag is the 94th Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. She previously served as a Hennepin County judge. Governor Mark Dayton announced her appointment to the new post back in June, which created a female majority on the court for the second time. McKeag, a descendant of the White Earth Nation, is the first Native American to serve on the state's highest court. McKeag's ceremony at St. Catherine University will feature a drum circle performance by students from her former high school. The White Earth Color Guard will also be there. McKeag already had a private swearing-in 2 weeks ago and has participated in the court's recent work. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Wages across Minnesota are finally showing signs of recovering after the Great Recession. Census numbers released today show increases in median household income last year across most demographic groups, as well as a decline in the number of people living in poverty in the state. But disparities still persist, with the median household incomes of blacks and American Indians trailing far behind whites and Asians in the state. John Collins has the story.
Median income for all Minnesotans increased by about $2,000 between 2014 and 2015. It now sits at more than $63,000, which is almost 14% higher than the national household income. Minnesota state demographer Susan Brower says Minnesota's increase follows similar patterns across the country.
It has been a slow recovery in terms of incomes, so that makes this release kind of what we've been waiting for some time, to see some of those incomes begin to rise.
Brower says the census numbers show improvement for much of the state's population.
Many of the economic improvements that we saw had broad reach, with reductions in the number and the prevalence of poverty for children under 18, of working age people and older adults, as well as Minnesotans who identify themselves as American Indian, black, or non-Hispanic white.
Still, disparities persist. While the median household income for whites is more than $66,000, median household income for black Minnesotans is less than half that, at just over $30,000. But the data released today does show that black household income did bounce back last year after an alarming drop of almost $4,000 in 2014.
More black Minnesota residents are moving into the labor force. Fewer are unemployed, more are working, and more are working in full-time jobs. But despite these positive signs, many of these new opportunities haven't yet translated into an increase in the rewards for work for black Minnesotans.
Minnesotans who identify as Hispanic and American Indian also trail whites in household income. State residents identified as Asian earn the most, with a median household income of more than $72,000. Craig Helmstetter is a senior researcher at Wilder Research. He says it's hard to tell from the data alone exactly why these disparities persist.
We've come to refer to this as the Minnesota paradox. You know, Minnesota overall has a really high quality of life, a relatively highly educated and high income state on the one hand. On the other hand, we have among the very worst disparities in the nation.
The drop in income reported last year for black Minnesotans triggered a response from community groups and political leaders. Governor Mark Dayton pushed for funding to try to address the disparities. The legislature approved a $35 million package that includes job training, educational programs, and help for small businesses. Anthony Newby is the executive director of Minneapolis-based Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. Newby says he's encouraged that political leaders from both parties supported the proposals as a start. But he says more work needs to be done.
It is a pragmatic issue of improving the quality of life for all citizens, including those who have been historically left out of the conversation and left out of the benefits of our thriving economy. Unless we have a deliberate plan to do that, it simply won't happen.
Apart from legislative efforts, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change is among the groups pushing for a citywide increase in the minimum wage in Minneapolis to $15 an hour. They believe a higher minimum wage would also help address income disparities. John Collins, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A number of Minnesota men who came to the United States as child refugees from Cambodia may soon be forced to return to a country they scarcely remember. That's because they were convicted of crimes as young adults, and the federal government is deporting them. The men's families are pressing authorities to let them stay, saying they've turned their lives around and have long been productive members of society. Matt Sepik has a closer look.
Cambodia in the 1970s was an awful place to be a child. A U.S. bombing campaign directed at the North Vietnamese Army gave way to the genocide of communist dictator Pol Pot. He forced city dwellers to work on collective farms. Over 4 years, an estimated 2 million Cambodians died. Many people were executed. Others succumbed to disease and starvation. More than 150,000 Cambodians would seek refuge in the United States. Among them was Chan Um. Now 46 years old, he's among 10,000 who eventually settled in Minnesota. But on August 26th, his life here was turned upside down. Um went to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Bloomington for a regular check-in because of a past felony conviction. His wife, Dina Pisset, explains what happened next.
35 minutes later, he called me and said, "I got locked up now. They took out everything. Can you just come and get the car?"
Pisset says Om doesn't talk much about his past, but court records show he was convicted in 2004 of taking part in the armed robbery of a St. Paul restaurant owner. A judge sentenced him to 3.5 years in prison. Today, Pisset says her husband has a steady job, volunteers at a Buddhist temple, and dotes on his young niece. During rush hour yesterday in downtown Minneapolis, Pisset stood in front of U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar's office alongside dozens of protesters. They were there to demand the release of Om and more than a half dozen other Cambodian men who also faced deportation. Since ICE detained Om nearly 3 weeks ago, his sister-in-law, Sovana Liang, says it's been tough trying to figure out exactly where he is.
Every time we call immigration, the inmate locator, or even call directly, they would just tell us they're going to here, 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 and it's not really where they're at until we actually get a phone call from our loved ones.
Just before last night's rally started, Om did call from Modesto, California. He'd also made stops with immigration officials in Louisiana and Arizona. Gasol Sek heads the International Khmer Assembly, a Cambodian-American advocacy group. He says the deportations are the result of an agreement the U.S. and Cambodian government struck in 2002. It allows refugees with criminal records to be deported. Sek says the Cambodians ICE is targeting for deportation are facing a second punishment for their crimes.
These are war victims from the Vietnam War. There are people that have served their time. They've been released into society. They have family members. They have wives. So they're fully functional members of society.
Sek says ICE has detained 7 Cambodians who'd been living in Minnesota, and at least one is already back in Southeast Asia. Paul Lely, an attorney who works with the Cambodian community, says the refugees facing deportation are caught up in an unfair system that fails to consider their individual circumstances. He says it's unconscionable that the U.S. government would treat the families of old allies in such a way.
Asylum doesn't go away because the political whims of a law change. They're the children of people who assisted this country. We brought them here. the last thing we should be doing is sending their children back to the place we saved them from.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement would not comment on specific cases, but a Twin Cities spokesperson for the agency says people awaiting removal from the United States could be released from custody if ICE is unable to obtain foreign travel documents or carry out a deportation order for some other reason. Senator Klobuchar's office says in a statement that she's meeting with Cambodian community members, quote, to see how we can help them. With reporting from Tim Nelson, I'm Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.